Hi, I'm Xaveria Simmons, and I'm welcoming you to the first episode of the Reading the Museum podcast. Whether you're an artist, arts worker, staff member, museum director, board member, advocate, or local community member, we hope that you will engage with the tools and resources inside of the RTM website. Today's episode of the podcast will feature Mickey Garcia, who is the executive director of the Arizona State University Museum, as well as myself. And we are the co-leads and co-founders of Reading the Museum. So we'll be talking a little bit about the origin story and also what to expect inside of the museum, and also a little bit about what to expect in the podcast, as well as how we formed Reading the Museum with a group of artists and arts workers and museum directors. So stick around, enjoy the episode, and we'll see you for podcast two. Bye. Hi, Mickey Garcia. How are you?
I'm so excited to be doing this podcast with you. How are you?
I'm great. I'm so thankful. I'm really excited. And it's been a long journey with us working together and being collaborators for a very long time. So I'm really excited.
Well, let's jump into it.
Okay, let's go.
All right. So I thought we would just jump into our biographies so that people could know who we are and have a little bit of our background and a sense of why we felt so inspired to do this RTM project. You want me to start?
Yeah.
My name is Mickey Garcia, and I am the director at ASU Art Museum, Arizona State University Art Museum. Been there about 6 years, and I'm coming to you from the Coronado neighborhood in Phoenix, Arizona. And my office in the museum is in Tempe, Arizona. I'm originally from Brownsville, Texas, which is a border town. Both my parents are multi-generational Tejanos, my mom being born in Matamoros, Tamaulipas, but having dual citizenship, and my dad from Kingsville, Texas. And both my parents were artists and educators, especially my dad was really involved in the Chicano civil rights movement. And through that, he was able to get a higher education. He got a master's degree and was an artist. And specifically, my upbringing with both my mom and my dad involved a lot of art museums. But I have had such different experiences visiting art museums in Mexico, for example, than visiting art museums in Texas, where we mostly went. And I have to say, I'm such a passionate advocate for art museums. Like, being a young kid going to Mexico and having my dad point out the Rivera murals and saying, like, this is you, these are your people, this is, you know, be proud of who you are, and sharing space with so many people. And then going to art museums in San Antonio and in Houston, and my dad showing me his favorite artists, like, you know, Paul Klee and Max Ernst, and those were also mine, those were also part of my human heritage. But, you know, visiting museums in the South and in Texas was really different. It wasn't a shared space. I didn't see myself in those spaces, not representations. I questioned the Alamo. You know, they were so different from the oral histories that my family taught me about the Rinches, the Rangers, versus the ones I was seeing in the museum. So I ultimately ended up studying art history and becoming a museum director and, you know, curator and then museum director. And I've worked all over, but I feel like I have this sense where I have moved up the ranks through museums because I really understand their fundamental transformative power. But I also really keenly see and feel the experience of being left out. That, I think, puts me in a position to really do this work, because I understand the potential, the good potential of museums, while also living the lived realities of the harms. And so that's, I think, a lot of what I'm bringing to this.
Thank you, Mickey. That was wonderful to just, I love hearing, you know, your origin story and also thinking about your family. I am Xaveria Simmons. I'm an artist. I'm an arts worker. I am the co-lead of Reading the Museum. I am from New York City. And so I spent my formative years going to museums. I remember being that kid who, you know, would go to the Met with like 25 cents and, like, you know, be intimidated. But I've spent most of my life going up and down Museum Mile in New York City, going to MoMA. All of those museums are sort of like a part of my DNA. Currently, I live in Los Angeles, which has a gorgeous amount of institutions, museums, and also smaller cultural institutions. institutions. And I also organize with artists and arts workers for better working conditions for artists and arts workers, better contract negotiations, just any kind of support we can give on the background that's not part of the structures of the museum currently. That's sort of the work I do on the background. But my work is I make installations, photographs, performances, like as many things as I can get my hands on in terms of art making, I do. And I also write extensively, make huge text work. So I'm really excited about the potential of museums, but I'm also deeply disappointed in the ways that museums function currently. And we'll get into that inside of the podcast. So that's who I am. I'm really excited to be here and to have been working with this cohort for the past almost 4 years on Reading the Museum.
Oh, that's amazing. And I think it's fair to say that we are both people whose lives have been transformed through art and artists. You know, I couldn't imagine my life without art and artists every single day. And that's kind of going to throw us to the origin story, because you and I have known each other for a very long time. And we met through working. You were, I believe,
I was at the Studio Museum. I was doing a project under the auspices of Thelma Golden and Christine Kim at the time. This is about 15 years ago
2005.
Or so. Yeah, so I'm making myself younger. 20 years ago. And Christine Kim actually commissioned me to do one of the Studio Museum's iconic Harlem postcards. And at that time, she asked Mickey to write about the postcard. So you can find that on Studio Museum's website. And from that, we developed a long relationship where Mickey has brought me into many of the institutions that she's helmed, and really, so we have a long relationship, me looking at her as a director, looking at her as a curator, and then she's looking at me through the lens of the artist. And we really came together, you know, for the sake of Reading the Museum during March 2020, during the pandemic, working from home. We were isolated, as we all remember, and the world was struggling to understand all of the impacts of being isolated. And then in the wake of all of this, we have the state-sanctioned murders of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, and a whole host of Indigenous Black, Brown people. And in that time, museums really, really began to struggle with the implications of being in the 21st century and all of the kind of issues that were coming, not only from the outside externally, but from the inside in terms of labor organizing inside of institutions and pushback from community members around all of the issues that communities local to institutions have with regards. And
yeah, I want to take a step back, because one of the things I was drawn to you immediately when we met and then subsequently is your humanity and the practice that you have that shows up in your work and the way that you've created your work. But you have always had a sense of self-care and a real sense of humanity around just like understanding and not otherizing people's experiences. And so, yes, you were, we were commissioning you to do a project for ASU Art Museum. But more than that, I think we were in the pandemic and we were talking almost daily, because I did reach out to folks like you to try to make sense of it because of your perspective as an artist, your perspective as someone who really has compassion, but also holds people accountable. And that's what we were looking at. We were looking at, you know, academia, you know, in my case, students, you know, holding academia accountable, healthcare, the theater was having a crisis, and the art world was having a crisis too. And, you know, in June 16th, 2020, there was the emergence of the social media account Changed the Museum. And it was one of many, I mean, this was an anonymous and for very good reasons, you know, a retaliation, but it was one of many anonymous first-person testimonies of arts workers who didn't have a voice anywhere else, who were describing in detail the harassment, the discrimination that was happening inside their museums. And we then also saw museums being called to task. If we think about the Guggenheim, New Orleans Museum of Art, SF MoMA, they were being called to task by these accounts, by these students. And it had us you know, and in your case, Siberia, you were working with arts workers who were unionizing, I mean, still to this day, but who were picking up momentum. And there was this kind of momentum where, because of the pandemic, because of George Floyd's murder, we were in a place where the field was actually listening and responding. But you and I were like, oh, wow, in order for higher, you know, for leaders to respond, they have to be called out. Is this really the only way we can get change?
And then also going back a little bit, you know, at that time during 2020, 2021, not only was I organizing with artists and arts workers, which I still do to this day, and who are part of our larger base, but also I was using social media to speak to these things because I saw the dearth of like action from museums. And it's also inside of my artwork, right? So you have an artist, and I'm one of many. You have an artist who is using their platforms to the best of their abilities to bring awareness, to make the shifts, to make the changes, and basically no responses. I mean, the responses I did get were a lot of requests from institutions and leaders, both board members and curators and directors, for Instagram takeovers so that they could justify, so that they could get help from me and other artists like me to justify the museum's presence and the museum's experience and how the museum is actually equitable and all of these things. And Mickey and I both went back and forth on our own as friends and as colleagues to say, like, this is happening. I told her, this is happening to me. I'm getting requests. And she was like, I'm also getting requests.
Well, one of the things we want to say too, Zai, is that people have been working for change since the advent of museums. And
exactly.
They're, you know, mass action, museum workers speak, empathetic
Faith
museum.
Ringgold.
Inclusion, visitors of color.
Yeah.
This is not, like, it didn't just happen. This is on the backs of people who have, like you, risked their careers, risked their time and energy, you know, to make change. I think what we were experiencing was just this inflection point where, you know, the world was suddenly in a different space and they were maybe listening in a different way. But there have been a lot there. I mean, what you and I have experienced with kids and I shouldn't call them kids, adults, people, arts workers who were working, have been working and facing harms. This has been happening for a really long time. But yeah, I mean, to throw it back. Yeah, we saw this, you know, we saw the demands from the social media and from accounts. There were a lot of them, you know, change this one, change that one. We saw them taking cover on the backs of artists. And what we saw too, as people were getting fired and they were getting, you know, the New York Times and the Washington Post and press started to actually give attention to this, you know, I'm involved in the American, you know, the Association of Art Museum Directors. And in that way, what I saw were leaders, directors really struggling. They were stuck between the moment at hand, their workers who were already in a pandemic, their own budget crises that they were having to deal with being in the pandemic, and then the needs and concerns of their board of governors, and directors serve at the pleasure of the board.
And I just want to interject and say that for artists and arts workers, and I will not speak for all artists and all arts workers. I'm going to speak for a particular type, people who are very similar to me, who are invested in like the whole ecology of being an artist as a job, as labor. You know, artists and arts workers have been saying this before the pandemic, before the crisis on the streets, before all of the Black and Brown state sanctioned murders. So for us, it's part of the work, the material inside of our work a lot of the time. So for us, it's kind of an easy step to look back and say, like, these are the issues tied to housing, health, mental health, economics, wealth, land, all of the things. These are the issues we already know because we use this material to inform our work.
I remember you said at that time when we were, so I think the background is that you were getting approached and I was getting approached because of my background, because I was also not afraid, not threatened and afraid of these things. I mean, sure, I was afraid, like, oh my gosh, are we going to get called out? Because we exist in a system that doesn't support, like, it's not just the individual director, or it's a system, and we can talk about that in our podcast, that doesn't support change. So, you know, I have a lot of empathy and humanity for the directors, my colleagues and peers who were facing these things. And a lot of them were calling me because I wasn't threatened. I was like, yes, this is the truth of the matter. You know, look at the statistics, you know, of representation, of audience, of collections. Yes, these demands for equity and for, you know, greater representation and greater fair pay, like, of course they're going to ask. We as a field may not have a solution, but we have to lean in and listen. So I was getting a lot of folks, maybe because of the color of my skin, maybe because of the way I was talking, possibly both, saying like, oh, would you, you know, in a way bless what I'm doing? Like, look, we're working with these activists. Isn't that great? Or what are you doing? You know, asking me. And so we were both getting, like, from both sides, you as an artist, me as a director, folks really struggling to grasp it. And what we saw were, I think the thing that when you and I were back there, it was like, oh my gosh, here's a token hire. They think that's going to fix it. You know, token okay, hire, everybody's reading White Fragility.
Exactly. Exhibition or calling me to put, I descend from chattel slavery. I say that in lectures. So calling me to justify, you know, all the existence of Blackness, which no one artist can do. No one museum director can do. No one individual can do the work for a museum, whether it be, like you said, Mickey, token hires, you know, museum exhibitions, EDIA groups, and none of those things can do, you know, the work of solving the issues inside of the institution related to white supremacy, racism, and all the rest.
But to my dismay, I think that a lot of folks really did think that, you know, and it's because we had a lot of EDI trainings and book clubs. And I remember the SF MoMA situation where they had just come out of an EDI training when the curator said, you know, oh, don't worry, we're going to continue to, you know, collect these kinds of things. Like, it was, you know, so it wasn't enough. And they are really important. Like, forming consciousness book clubs is really important. Having people to speak to is really important. Training on just the basic knowledge of equity versus equality, really important. But they weren't sustained, and they weren't, like, they're not, they were not going to be the key to rooted.
Exactly.
Rooted change.
There's nothing wrong with book clubs, listening sessions, all those things, but those things at some point have to lead to action. And I think as an artist, as an arts worker, as someone who shows in museums across the world, if there is no action behind your land acknowledgement or your consistent showing of Black and Brown people without an interrogation into reparations and all the rest, and also the larger systemic whiteness and white supremacy, if there is no interrogation into those things and actual actions related to undoing, we're just in a kind of like stasis.
Well, and even further, and I think this is where you and Cruz Ortiz, who's a member of our cohort, you know, really worked on this diagram that you all worked on and were inspired by the Safe Houses Progressive Alliance, who had this diagram of the Black woman who enters
a nonprofit
or a job or anything really. And the Black woman could stand for any kind of change. So one of the things that I think happens is that we were so dismayed that there was so much money and attention in this moment. And yet, The conversation was really around A to B. Like, if I do this, then I get this. And it was this, like, I'll just hire this person and check mark. I'll just read this book and check mark. And really, for someone who's lived in this space, you know, we've lived this life, it's ongoing, it's iterative, it's never ending, and it has to have a root cause. And you and Cruz Ortiz, you know, really looked at this graph from the Safe House Progressive Alliance for Nonviolence of the Black woman who really represents change to the status quo.
Exactly.
And so what happens is, and you can describe it, but what happens is when you are inviting change into an organization and you're not prepared for it, harm happens. And you can describe it, but we had been looking at the Mellon Foundations, they had funded, based on this demographic study of, like, the disastrous results of such poor representation and diversity in art museums that they started all these fellowships and internships. So you were creating this pipeline, but the system wasn't ready. And so there was all this harm happening. Exactly. Do you want to talk about the graph?
Yeah. And I'll just briefly talk about the graph. So the graph basically describes a Black woman enters the museum. She enters the museum. There's a honeymoon period with the board, with the executive leader, and she may enter as an executive leader or a board member, or she could be a curator, or she could be an artist, or she could be a worker inside of the institution. And this applies to nonprofits, universities, and philanthropy and foundations, etc. But either which way, she enters the museum. There's a honeymoon period. Everyone's excited. She's excited. They're excited. She starts doing her labor, her work for whatever position she's in. And she starts realizing there's issues here, whether they be equity, labor, racial issues, sexism, patriarchy. She realizes there's an issue and she starts to point out these issues. And when she starts to point out these issues, the leadership starts to pause, hold back, and then eventually blames her for the issues. She points it out. She tells the board. She tells the directors, whoever's her you know, manager or supervisor, and they kind of retract. And all of a sudden, it's her issue. She's the problem. She's the reason why the institution is the way it is. They pit Black and brown people against each other because maybe one person's in leadership. Maybe one person is the Black woman, and they had affinities at first, but now all of a sudden there's a rift. And then the organization continuously blames her. And then eventually she leaves, whether she's pushed out or she leaves on her own. And that's kind of the pattern that's happened, you know, for many, many years. And we looked at this actually after Reading the Museum had already been in full swing for a couple of years. Did we bring this graph out and really see it clearly, see the pattern clearly? And it's very interesting that it comes with permission from the Safe House Progressive Alliance for Nonviolence, which is a domestic violence group who takes care of women in Colorado.
Because I think it is really at the core, and we'll talk about it in just a second, but at the core of what Reading the Museum is addressing the root issue and understanding that change is not something you can farm out. It's not something you can, you know, change in your personal life, in your children's life, you know, any kind of change is disruptive. And you have to prepare yourself for the change, you meaning an institution, you know, you have to prepare yourself for the change before inviting a change maker or, you know, and that's where we were just so dismayed. So here we were in the pandemic, and I have this little group of colleagues that I've been friends with for many years, Rocio Aranda Alvarado and Deborah Cullen, who I've known, you know, since I was in graduate school. And Deb works at the Mellon Foundation, Rocio works at Ford Foundation. And from their vantage points, they were seeing many of the similar things happening with requests for cover to them, you know, as well. And we, all of us, I think, have these shared values. And so Rocio and Deb were very intrigued by the idea that a director and an artist were having these conversations together.
Yeah, because that's really the crux.
Yeah, because the delta between where arts workers were and where museum leadership was vast, you know? And, you know, there was the infamous Black Square, you know, like, what museum leaders were doing versus what was actually, you know, and it instantly was backfired, you know, because these answers, these reactivities were not holding up, right? And so I remember in a conversation with Deb, she said to me, she's like, well, you guys have this really unique position in that you can see, you know, you're a bridge in a lot of ways, but also, okay, so we're being called out. So the field is being called out. You're saying that the responses are not adequate for long-term sustained change. What would you all do? Because I think there is also this like exasperation from some parts. Me, I will say, okay, what do we do about it? you know, like, okay,
solutions based. So, because we know the grievances, just to jump in, we all know the grievances. You know, we have the grievances on our website, which we'll talk about later, but we all know, we know the issues.
Yeah.
What are some solutions we can get into?
Right. And so they, you know, they said, well, do you have a proposal for us? And we had at that point, really, this had been just so organic. And we got together, we hustled and got together and wrote a proposal. And in September 2020, we're awarded a $1.5 million grant from Ford and Mellon Foundations called Reading the Museum, that we called Reading the Museum, that was going to be an attempt to provide solutions and provide methodology and provide a framework for both arts workers as well as museum leaders and anyone really in the field wanting to address systemic change. And what we did was we established a cohort. I mean, we were paving the ground as we were walking on it, really, in those first early days. And we would have loved to have done a really rigorous search of folks, but in the time that we had, and with our own labor and time and commitment, lifelong commitment to this work, we kind of reached out to our trusted base, our trusted relationships. And we formed a cohort of 10 folks that would come together and help us really build the framework. The other thing we did, and it was artists, leaders, curators, poets. It was, you know, not just, because I think that one of the things I was witnessing, Xaveria, was that when I was looking at the op-eds around this, it was curators and museum directors being given the field. And when I was in AAMD or Contemporary Art Museum Directors circles, and we were in the best faith, good faith efforts to think about this, it was still just us. And I'm like, all of us, we all benefited from the system. You know, even me, we all benefited. How are we supposed to think about change when we're the ones that have been part of the system?
Part of the system and part of the issues.
Yeah. So one of the things we wanted to do was really invite different voices that are not part of the system. And it's been hard, but it's been worth it. And I'm looking at all of us.
Yes.
But then we brought this group together and it's evolved over time, just the way museum staffs evolve and, you know, people evolve in and boards evolve. But we brought this in. And then what we also did is we, instead of bringing in a tried and true museum consultant, we chose to bring in community organizers from Arizona called Insight, who we, before we even met as a cohort, you and I did a lot of like personal and executive coaching. And Insight Consultants was vital. They were critical in helping me and you just think about how to approach this, because I'm not a community organizer. I'm a director. I got to get the budget. I got to get people paid. I got to get the strategic plan going. I got to fundraise. So this really helped me even think about, okay, how do you bring a community organizing lens? So by the time we met in December 2020, we had a sense of this was going to be a different kind of approach, but we still didn't really have the fully baked, this is what it's going to be.
No, because we wanted to make sure that we left room for it to be an organic, blooming, blossoming with the people who were engaged in the cohort. We also knew that we decided, you know, this cohort was going to make the decisions collectively, right? Like make a lot of the decisions and make the recommendations, because traditionally with this type of work, like Mickey said, it's usually a white paper, someone, you know, the directors write or the curators write or someone writes and they have graphs and data and that's it. And what we realized was we need to make this come alive. This has to be a living process that individuals can take and digest and move collectively together. So we, you know, as we were in the pandemic, we decided that as a group, we would meet together safely where we could where we were in right relationship with community members. And so we formulated a series of working retreats in the communities that we are from, actually, so that we had people locally who were engaged with us, that we also could make sure to use the resources in the environments that needed them the most.
And that's how kind of it formed as a proof of concept.
Exactly.
We basically said, if we can undergo change and we can enact the principles we think are going, and we'll talk about them in just a second here, that we think lead to actually root systemic change. If we can do it, then we can be this proof that it can be scaled.
And we really have to give some love to, and you did it already, but again, to Insight, because they really held us to the line that, like, they were not there to hold our hand and walk us through the changes that needed to happen. Everyone knows the changes. It's like, you have to embody those changes.
Yeah. It's like, you can learn, you can read something, but you have to experience it for it to actually, like, live in your body. And so in those, you know, in those retreats in Santa Fe, in Phoenix, in Richmond, in Santa Barbara, in Oakland, in Oaxaca City, each of those times, we enacted a behavior and a methodology that was really hard, that really made us formulate, okay, this is how it's done. So yeah, we met. And then we developed these core principles of Reading the Museum. That really is like the bedrock on which Reading the Museum rests on. Through these retreats, we kind of solidified or crystallized them. And I'll talk about the first one, you can talk about the second one, but these core principles, I mean, I think the main thing in this phase one, because we always conceived of Reading the Museum as being different stages, and Insight really helped crystallize that you have to have different stages of change. And that for us, if you yourself as a person were not 100% ready to be in a state of change and to personally commit to what does change mean? It means discomfort. It means wrestling with shame. It means unlearning the things that we've learned. And really,
It might mean rupture.
It means holding space. It might be, you know, but all of the things that happen in any kind of change that, you know, and that black woman diagram you talked about is like everything breaks down when someone is uncomfortable and unwilling to stay in that discomfort because they haven't wrestled with their shame or with the labor it takes or with unlearning. And that's when things break down. That's what prevents it from systemic change. So if you could, that it would be voluntary, not required, and that you would be basically sick and tired of being sick and tired of the same old thing, that you yourself, and it starts with the individual. That's the first core principle.
And the second one is really centering the base or centering the leaders, you know, centering the base of people who have been calling on the institution in the local community, right? Like, we're not talking, I mean, the base is not only, you know, the people inside of the institution, but it's also, you know, housing advocates, mental health practitioners, and a whole activist, people who dissent. That is the base, which is a difficult concept for museums to usually grasp because they're used to putting those things representationally, but not in positions where they can make things. So one of the core principle is centering the base and not having leaders talking to themselves.
And that's part of our cohort. But honestly, I think as museums, and I want to be really clear about this because I think that we've been set up to serve the base, serve the audiences. But when it comes to decision making, when it comes to finance committees or policy issues, that is not centering the base. That is centering people who have influence and power. And that's just the way the museum is set up. So we challenged. In Reading the Museum, we challenge you to set what does it look like, and our podcast will, really unpack this. What does it look like when you actually bring in not people that you serve, but that people that own? Like, what does it look like to have a distributed ownership of people who are really the people that are making power? The third one is one that you really taught me in a lot of ways. And it's doing your own labor. And we saw this, like we saw during that time when you and I were getting called, like, hey, Mickey, can you share your policy with me? Hey, can you, what book are you reading? Can you send me your lit book list? And, you know, I would say like, your definition of Latinx in Brooklyn Heights is going to be really different than my definition of Latine or Latinx in Phoenix. I have to do the labor of being in my relationship, in my space, in my museum, of really being a service in order for me to come up with the word that makes sense for my community. Exactly. It's not a plug and play. You can't copy paste this stuff.
No, and you even can't read. I mean, we can all read well-intentioned writings. Like, for instance, everyone was very excited about, let's say, the, you know, 1619 project. I'm going to use that for instance. And that's a real resource. It's an amazing resource of information and knowledge and learning. But if you don't have a clear understanding of some of the terminology that's used, then you just read it and you keep it moving. And it doesn't apply to the institution or the mechanics of the institution. And I think it's really important that we are specific together. And so our core principle is doing your own labor, learning the definitions of the words that you're thinking about, and also doing the labor of undoing a lot of the things that we are comfortable with on a daily basis inside of the institutions we work in. So the last core principles are accountability and community agreements. And those are critical. I mean, accountability is really the kind of the nexus, if that's the word, the nexus of Reading the Museum. It's the core. It is the reason for our existence in the sense that we are offering the solutions-based methodology that looks at the accountability mechanisms inside of institutions and changes that framework.
And can I add a little bit about that?
Of course.
I think accountability, again, is different than your mission, like a museum's mission. Because what we were seeing when we were forming this back in 2020 was that these social media and press were holding museums accountable in ways that the museums weren't holding themselves accountable, right? So only when it made the press or it made a thing did an institution hire an activist or make a token hire or fire someone. It was only, you know, with secret recordings and all of these things. And we just can't, as a field, rely on that as a as an actual way to do our good job. You know, we need to do better. And so when I, as a director, was looking at you and you were questioning, you were like, Mickey, you know, how does it all work? And I was thinking, well, you know, directors, we serve at the pleasure of the board, and the board is responsible for hiring and firing the director and for policy making. And the mission, you know, museums, if they don't do their job, what happens, right? So what does do their job mean? It means being on budget, you know, and reporting to the IRS, keeping your 501c3 status, and, you know, keeping your donor base happy so that you can continue to pay the bills. That's do your job. But if you are an educator and you go out and you do a harmful thing, where's the accountability for that?
No. If you're a museum director who does a harmful thing inside of the institution, where's the accountability except for the board?
Well, but so it's a particular group of people holding, you know, if someone is you know, of course there's HR and there's all of these methods, but they did not seem to be sufficient. And so we were really looking at how does a museum establish an accountability with the people it is in relationship with that actually is positive? Not, I don't want to be Pollyanna, but that's actually works, that is responsive and adaptive.
I think of Reading the Museum as a digestive process, right? Like you take in information collectively, which we'll talk about in our later podcast. You talk about information collectively, you make community agreements, you think collectively, you adhere to the community agreements because those are the guardrails that help you not retaliate and go off the rails as you're doing your individual and collective learning. That's how you keep it, which we're going to talk about later.
Right. And now, community agreements are your employee handbook.
Right. And that's not produced, you know, collectively with a group of people who are digesting all of the things inside of the institution. If anything, those things are made with either board oversight and or executive director, you know, but that
or
that
legal.
That ecology is not the full ecology of an institution.
Well, it doesn't produce a culture of courage and risk and change. And a lot of the way that we are in the United States, if I was in three, is that we want to understand the fear-based decision-making that's happening and want to kind of transform it. And so ultimately this, you know, right now we're seven member cohort. We're continuing the work because I think that in this principle, there's an unspoken, this is never ending. Like it's always like your learning and your commitment to change will continue through the course of your life. Just like your
commitment to art. But I do want to jump in and say, yes, it's never ending, but there are steps you can take, right? Like things are never ending. And there's also tangible things that can change the material, psychological, physiological, environmental conditions that are inside of institutions. So I just want to make that clear. Because when we say never ending, we're meaning as life grows, as world events come in, as new meanings evolve, we all have to continue to learn together and keep this digestive body going. But there are markers of like, and your museum or group will decide those together. There are tangible markers that will say, hey, we're on the right path to readying our museum or being readier than we were before. So right. I just want to put that on.
Yeah. I mean, we have a steps-based project here. Our podcast is, you listen to a podcast, we recommend exercises, and you follow those exercises, and you can evaluate where were you at the beginning, you know, baseline versus how is the organization and you changing. And our podcast will suggest that people form, you know, cohorts and sub cohorts. It's going to suggest that people do writings and individual kind of key performance indicators, and that policies will start to change and that culture will start to change. And I guess what I meant was more like you can't just hire a consultant, they come in, they do it, and then, you know, on to climate change, you know, like in the museum. Like it's not something that is an ad hoc committee. This is just, you know, as important as your finance committee is, you know, or like
it is as important as your board of trustees
or your exhibitions. It's got to be, it's just, you know, it's the way you move.
It's the way you move, and it should be a part of all of the systems inside of the institution.
But I do, because I do want to say that, you know, we're this group of seven and we have moved. I just want to, you know, shout out the people who've been instrumental in supporting the work in the phase one. It was Megan Smiley. It has been Aaron Walker. Freddie Janka was part of that phase one. And then all of the artists and laborers and community organizers insight who have really helped shape. We did not act alone. We never act alone. And that is something that, you know, was really, really important for us to always name the arts workers that were actually helping us do the work. So that's, you know, thank you, Zai, for always calling that out whenever we can for those of us that are just like, you know, so we're, you know, we're kind of at the end of this podcast, and there are just some notes around getting started, and just some notes I think that we want folks to remember about how this podcast is going to go down. Like, I will just start by saying that, you know, what we're sharing is just basically our experience, our, you know, knowledge, our strength, our hope, and how we did it. We are not therapists. We are not facilitators. We are not, you know, or some of us are community organizers. Some of us are not. This is really how we were coached, how we kind of came together to create this proof of concept. And we're just going to share with you what it's like and make recommendations for you to involve yourself in this and begin. I also think it's a loose fitting garment. Like what applied in one setting may not apply to another setting. So take the ideas as suggestions,
And we made this, we made our website, our deliverable, our main body. We made it open source so anyone can use it. It's open to individuals. It's open to groups. It's open to collectives. Obviously, we would love to also hear and understand how museums, how individuals, how groups are using these materials. Please be in touch with us as you go through the process. That's really our main desire.
What you'll have is our educational guide for this podcast is us asking you to commit to the work, asking your, you know, your staffs, your teams, your neighbors, whoever is doing this work, and to form a cohort, you know, form a cohort. We will give you some documents that you can kind of look to see if you're, to assess if you're ready.
Your readiness assessment. Yeah.
Yeah. And to show you some of the agreements that might help sort of start to launch this work. We do recommend hiring a facilitator if at all possible. We don't want to put one person on the line who may have to take a fall, or, you know, like having someone who can be a facilitator the way Insight was for us for a good period of time, and then really getting through, just holding us, you know, holding yourselves accountable to the work. But we definitely think, you know, the Reading the Museum website, it's dense. There's a lot of stuff in there. It's really great textbook. Going through the podcast and going through the exercises is going to really maneuver the way. But we're just so thrilled. And like Zai says, we are looking for feedback. We want you all to hold us accountable to this work. It's hard. It's to this day, receiving feedback is...
It's the most difficult thing.
It is because we're like people pleasers. We want to perform. We want to do our best.
And I'm not a people first pleaser.
That's right. She's a Taurus. I am.
I'm not a people pleaser, but I am, you know, one thing
that... Wanting you to do your best.
I want to do my best. And I think we all want to do our best to various degrees. And I think a really great resource on our website, if you're just like, I got to dive in, is looking at our FAQs. Our FAQs actually answer, they're the first thing you see after our landing page on the website. And they're really helpful because they help you to get the jitters out, understand some of the questions that others have asked us. Because, and I will say, everything that you see on the site has been accounted for by first our cohort, our project partners. Manager, and then our project partners, and then for some of us, some of our community, sometimes it's our partners, whatever the case, everything you're reading on the site has been looked over by many, many hands. And that's the one of the recommendations, which we don't mention, but which is something that I find really heartening, is I imagine a museum that can have many, many hands on it, that can make many, many decisions while still being caring and thoughtful to both its staff, its workers, its financial mechanisms, and also the objects, and also, obviously, most importantly, the communities that are surrounding the institution.
So that's a little teaser for phase two work that we're doing, I would say. Yeah, I think that this is just lastly, I think before we, you know, log off and say goodbye, is that I think one of the reasons to listen to this podcast that I think is the most compelling is that we're personal. We really, you know, what you'll hear in the podcasts is our own stories. This is not an academic approach here. We are not trying to get into the theories. We're really trying to be super personal about what this work means to us and how we have transformed doing this work. So thanks.
Welcome to Reading the Museum.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. See you at the next one.
Bye.
Reading the Museum's podcast series is hosted by artist Zyveria Simmons and is created by the Reading the Museum cohort, which includes Director of Oakland Art Museum of California, Lori Fogarty, Director and Professor of Practice at ASU Art Museum, Mickey Garcia, Board Chair of MCA Santa Barbara, Frederick Janka, Artist Chinupa Hanska-Luger, Artist Cruz Ortiz, Executive Director of Elizabeth Foundation for the Arts, George Shear, Chief Curator and Director of Curatorial Affairs of Phoenix Art Museum, Olga Viso, and Artist Zyveria Simmons. Aaron Donahue is our Project Manager and Producer. Castos Productions is our production company, with a special thanks to Iselle Brill and Craig Hewitt. Cruz Ortiz created the original cover art for our podcast. Funding for readying the museum comes from the Ford Foundation and Mellon Foundation, with additional support from ASU Art Museum and Arizona State University Herberger Institute for Design and the Arts. Because readying the museum is a collaboration between artists, arts workers, and museum directors, we would also like to thank the artists, studios, and their collaborators for their time and effort. You can sign up for our newsletter at readyingthemuseum.com. We're on Instagram at readyingthemuseuminfo. We're also on YouTube at Readying the Museum, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever else you listen to podcasts. Don't forget to check out the show notes for links to resources and more information on today's topics. Be sure to join us next week when we dive into new Readying the Museum episodes.